Welcome to Perspective Transformation with Marnie and Friends. Whether you're looking for encouragement, practical training, or clear focus, you'll want to grab a notebook, as today's guest trainer shares rock-solid strategies you can implement starting immediately. Sponsored by WomenSpeakers.com, here's your host, Marnie Swedberg.
Hi, this is Marnie, and I'm happy to have you with us as we talk today with Doris Swift on the topic of moving from fear to faith. We got a bunch of Doris's favorite aha moments to share with you, phrases and quotes that have become precious to her over the years as God has carried her in many different types of situations, from being a little unsure or even fearful, all the way over to faith and just pursuing God's dreams for her. I want to introduce her first to you before I bring her on here. Doris Swift is an author, speaker, and podcast host. She is passionate about encouraging women to walk in their calling and use their gifts to impact the world for Christ. Her name is Doris Swift. Her website is Doris Swift, and you can learn more about her over at womenspeakers.com under Florida. Welcome to you, Doris.
Thank you, Marnie. I'm so excited to be here with you. Such a pleasure.
Oh, and I'm so excited to pick your brain. We're going to dive right in. Your first quote that we want to talk about today is, "Our calling isn't built in a day. It unfolds in many ways over our lifetime."
Absolutely. It unfolds in many ways, because sometimes we feel like our calling is this one huge big thing that we're looking toward, like we're waiting for, you know, like Moses parting the sea or something like that. But honestly, God uses us all throughout our life, and he equips us to walk in a calling each season of our life. So we might be, you know, called to be maybe a mom in this season. And then when emptiness comes, we're called to do something else, maybe to write or speak. But it's just not one big thing oftentimes.
Right. The core that we know for sure is that we're uniquely created in God's image, but for a specific purpose on earth. I'm not doing what you're doing. You're not doing what I'm doing.
Yes. Yes. That's for sure.
And then, right, it really radically changes. I was just thinking earlier this week, if you would have told me in my 20s or 30s that I'd be doing what I'm doing today, I would have just said, I think you've got the wrong person. I don't think that would be possible.
Yeah.
Right?
God does that. Yeah.
He does. And it's the desire of my heart to do exactly what I'm doing right now.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And you feel that peace about it. And you just know when you're in the moment of it, you know, this is what I'm called to do in that moment.
Right. You know? Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. The next one is, our ministry is wherever we are, woven into the tapestry of God's amazing plan.
Yes, because we may be working in a job somewhere thinking, oh, if I could just leave this job, maybe I can do more ministry work. Or if I could just leave this or that, I could do more for the Lord. Well, he has us in certain places for his purpose. So we can look at it through God's eyes, open our eyes, and see why we're in a certain place, that he does have a purpose for us there. And so that is where our ministry is where he has us right now.
The tapestry thing is such a great, I love that illustration, you know, of the backside. That's the side we see of the, you know, embroidery picture. You know, there were a few years ago, there was 4 months when I went and stayed with my mom because she was losing her mind to dementia. So confusing. There was another 6 months when I went to work for a moving company as a sales rep because that was God's next step for me. So confusing. I mean, all this happened just in like the last 3 years. And sometimes this backside of this tapestry is really disheartening. It's like, what am I doing here? Why is this happening to me? I don't see how this has anything to do with the calling that I feel like you've got on my life. When that happens to you, what do you do?
Well, seek the Lord first off, because any kind of angst that we have is not coming from him. So when we seek his face and we ask him to open our eyes to the divine appointments that are right in front of us each day, because if we're not watching intentionally, we're going to miss them. What is the person that he's putting in our life that day that needs to hear hope, needs to hear truth, and needs to hear about him? And that is why we're at a certain place at a certain time. You know, we never know until we ask God to open our eyes so we can see the opportunities there. And it's really precious.
I love that too. I know that's what carried me through. And you have this picture of this tapestry and it's got all kinds of different colors in it. And some of them are gray.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yes.
When God opens our eyes to see hard things, it ignites our passion and compassion, convicting us to take action.
Yeah. There are so many hard things in the world today going on, and oftentimes we want to close our eyes to them because it bothers us. But that is the place where oftentimes God is calling us and convicting us in his spirit to move in some way and take action. So wherever those feelings of conviction and passion and compassion come to an intersection, that's where he's calling us to take action and do something. I was on a mission trip that was going to Detroit to visit this women's transitional shelter. And it was heartbreaking to see how that, you know, is so hard on these women. They're coming out of abusive situations, but, you know, opening our eyes to that allows us to minister to who is hurting.
Right, right. I often think if we could just, you know, there's the saying, walk a mile in another's shoes. Mm-hmm. And really, honestly, until you see some of that stuff, you don't even have a clue.
Yeah.
And we never can really fully experience the intensity that they experience walking through that. But it does broaden our horizons and bring us more passion and compassion toward their situation.
Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah.
And yeah, calling us to bring hope. That's what we're called to do, is to share the love of Christ and the hope that they can have, you know, in him and the peace.
Right, right. Instead of saying, I'm not enough, we can say, I don't need to be enough because Jesus is enough for the both of us.
Yeah. Jesus is enough. His grace is sufficient. The world will tell us that we have to be enough, that it's all about us, that we have to be perfect and all, but really, God's grace is sufficient. So we don't have to worry about focusing so much on ourselves. When we turn our trajectory around and look at him and be him to other people, we just take our eyes off of ourselves, because worrying about whether we're enough or not, that's not really where God wants us. He is enough for us.
No, I think a lot of times people, that verse about God will never give you more than you can handle. Mm-hmm. I think the thing that's the unwritten parenthesis there is that you can handle with him.
Right.
Because he never really expects us to be enough.
Yes. He never expects us to be enough. And he wants us to see that we do have more than we can handle, because we cannot do it on our own. Right. We find strength in him. And that's what, you know, that's the perfect place for us to be.
Yeah, I love that so much. God uses change to make us move. When we stay stuck in our familiar, we miss reaching our full potential.
Yes. We can get stuck in what we love as routine. Like, I remember one time when I went into my local grocery store, I loved that I knew where everything was so I could get in and out of there quick. Well, they flipped the milk to another aisle. And I was like, where's my milk? Who moved the milk? And it just like bothered me so much. And we can get in that kind of rhythm where we get set in our ways. And God says, you know, I'm going to change some stuff up here and cause you to have to move. You know, whether it's maybe a job that, you know, is no longer there, maybe, you know, you're working for a company that then next thing you know, you're not, you know, he has more for us. And so that's what we need to look at, the change as being an opportunity, you know, not be annoyed that our milk got moved.
When we bought a retail store, which was in 2006, and now we've sold it a few years ago. But when we bought it, one of the things they trained us was that you need to keep moving things around. And they said, quote, people will get really upset with you, but you have to do it in order to survive. And it's like, wow, this change thing, we hate it. Like you said, I still hate it when they move my stuff, even though I know they have to. But, you know, it is to help us not get stuck in a rut, not get settled in and never even see what's down the next aisle of life.
Yes.
God keeps changes these things so that we have the opportunity to see what else he's got there for us.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Dreams don't determine who we are. Who we are determines our dreams.
Yes. Who we are determines our dreams, because we hear so much about follow your dreams and all of that. The first thing we're to do is seek the kingdom of God, and all else will be given unto us. So when our heart lines up with the Lord's, then our desires lean into his plans for our lives. So our dreams actually can change over time to line up with what he truly is calling us to do. And so our identity is really where the dreams come out of, and our identity is in Christ. So that is the way that we can look at our dreams, that that's truly where God has us going.
That verse that says that trust in the Lord and he will give you the desires of your heart. You know, that one can be both and.
Yes.
He gives you the desires in your heart. So first he puts the desire in your heart, and then he gives you the desire that was in your heart.
Exactly.
I love it that is both and that mm-hmm. way. And that's exactly what you're saying about how when we're walking with God, it is the dreams that are leading us.
Yes.
And the dreams are from him. Beautiful.
Exactly. Yes.
Earthly time loses its value in the big picture of God's timing.
Yes. We hate to wait. Don't we? We don't really like waiting, although we know that sometimes we need to just rest in him, but we feel like we always need to be doing something and making something happen. And so we have to just take a step back and take a breath and know that God's plans are so much better. Like, he could give us what we're asking for, like today or yesterday even, but he wants it to be what's best for us, and that will give him the most glory. So waiting for the way he wants it to all plan out and pan out, that's what we want to do, because his big picture is something that we can't see right away. You know, we just see what's right in front of us, but we have no idea what's waiting on the other side. So
for sure. I'm thinking of it both ways again. I'm thinking about a parent, a loving parent who doesn't let the child open the Christmas gift until Christmas. Mm-hmm. They make them wait for something good. And also the loving father who answered my daddy's prayer, but not mine. So my dad would always mm-hmm. pray that he would go home early enough that he didn't become a burden to his four girls. So he didn't want to grow old and become a burden to us, because he didn't have any sons, and he felt like it was just like awful if he got old and we'd have to take care of him, the big man of the family. Mm-hmm. And so there was a day that he died suddenly of a massive heart attack, and he was just instantly gone. And my comfort in that was that even though I didn't get the timing I wanted for my dad's home going, he got exactly what he had prayed for. He didn't suffer. It was just over in a moment, and he was home with Jesus. So whatever you guys are dealing with today, just remember God's got the timing. God's got your back. In fact, he's got everything over, under, beside, around, in, and through you. And he's flowing his life to you first. Can't give away what you don't already have. Doris Swift, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Marnie. It's been such a joy to spend time with you.
And you guys want to check out Doris's website over at DorisSwift.com. And of course, she is available for speaking engagements online or on in premise over at WomenSpeakers.com. Under Florida, you'll find her right there. Dr. Gail Hayes. I'm excited to introduce her. We're going to be talking about the power of a woman who leads. Now, Dr. Gail is an award-winning author and former law enforcement officer. Her message of hope regarding racism and the law enforcement culture in America is being shared globally. She was just recently interviewed on the BCC News in London, as well as she's shared on U.S. platforms, including Thrive Global, and is being scheduled to provide corporate and nonprofit training programs throughout the U.S. You can learn more about her at womenspeakers.com. She's in North Carolina there, and also at her own website, handleyourbusinessgirl.com. I love it. Welcome to you.
Oh, thank you, Marty. Thank you so much for having me. You bring a big smile to my face.
and you mine. And I'm so excited to be talking to you today about your book, The Power of a Woman Who Leads. And this is not just for managers, but it definitely is ideal for someone who's in a management position or looking to lead some type of a group of or organization. So one of the things I love that you have in this book, and I am such a test taker, Gail. I love taking personality tests and all that. You know, this is my favorite thing. So I had so much fun taking your leadership test here. And there are six different kinds of leaders that you really dive into in the book. The activist, strategist, tactical, creative, collaborative, and dramatic leader. And I was kind of, I'm like this with personality tests too. I'm very much in the center clump. I have a little bit outside edge and then I just kind of in the center with all of it. And so that's how I was with you exactly, which made me laugh. I scored high on the first, on the middle four. So I'm not too much of an activist or a dramatist. But I'm very strong in strategic, tactical, creative, and collaborative, which is so funny and just not surprising to me at all. Because in the back of the book, you talk about the different parts of the body that each of these leaders is. And the parts that I am are more like the heart and the hugs and like that. And that is so how I lead. That's awesome. We were talking before we came on air that you are the flexible, more of a flexible leader. So tell us about that.
Well, I'm a tactical leader. It's a military term. A lot of these are military terms. I'm a military brat. And so I remember I was calling myself a strategic person. And my husband said, stop calling yourself a strategist. I said, but I am. He says, no, you're a tactician. I said, what's the difference? He said, a strategist is at the battle command, at the command center. They're developing the war plans. He said, but they hand the war plans to the tactical leader in the field. He said, they tell him to tell the tactical leader to take a city, and there's a bridge that leads to the mountain that overlooks the city. When they get there, there's no bridge, and the tactical leader takes the city anyway.
That's you. That's right. Yeah, in fact, we're going to share some of your favorite aha moments. And your first one I wanted to talk about is sometimes God will send you where you do not want to go.
For instance, I never planned to be a law enforcement officer. Never in my wildest dreams. I was challenged. I met the chief of police for the department that I ended up working for. I was having a dinner party with a friend. They wanted to hire him. And the chief of police started talking to him. He was ignoring me. And I said, he told him to come and fill out an application. And because this man was ignoring me, I said, excuse me, I'll be there too. And he turns his back on me during the conversation. Well, at the end of the day, Marnie, I got hired. He didn't. And I became the first Black female police officer in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and the first Black female firefighter.
Wow.
So I didn't want to go there. That was not some place that I wanted to go. My background was fashion and the theater. And I ended up being a law enforcement
officer. You are an all-around law enforcement officer.
I was that. But, you know, I learned a lot about working with men. I learned a lot about working with men, which helps me do what I do now, helping women in their communication with men and vice versa. I do a lot of work helping the genders to know each other, to understand each other better. And that job really served me well.
You have such a unique background that comes, you know, you bring these insights to male, female, Black, white, you know, corporate and non-corporate. You have all of this background that just makes you such an ideal person, right? For such a time as this, actually, we just need your insights so much. And it's so beautiful that you're sharing them all around the world, which is really, really cool. Your next quote is, if you don't know who you are, you will never know what belongs to you.
You know, when I went on a search for identity when I was a little girl, when I was 5 years old, my father moved us to Asia, to Japan. And I had my first experience. I didn't know I was Black, Okay, I did not, no. My mother and father did not talk to me about race. And so when I went to the second grade, my mother brought me a box of Crayola crayons with a sharpener on the back. You know those? And the first thing I did was find my skin color. So I went to class and I had this little boyfriend. This little boy wanted to be my boyfriend. He'd sit like this in front of me. So I knew he must have thought I was pretty and smart because that's what my grandmother told me. And I'll never forget, I found his skin color because he was my boyfriend. You have to be my boyfriend. So when I asked him to be my boyfriend, Marnie, he changed my life with one finger. And he said, no, he rubbed the back of my hand. And I was like, what's wrong with my hand? He said, you're black. Well, I was ready for him. I said, I am not black. I am Sienna. And he was upset. And he said, I said, okay. He got really upset. And I said, well, okay, if I'm black, what color are you? He said, I'm white. I said, no, you're not. You are salmon pink. And he was the prettiest little blue-eyed, blonde-haired boy I'd ever seen. And what happened was when we had this exchange at 7 years old, it set my feet on the path for identity. I wanted to know who I am and why would God create me to look like I look and people didn't like it. And really what it was is I ended up loving me. And understanding the melanin and understanding what God created. He just allowed me to be in a multicultural environment and stand and be recognized and also to teach others about differences because of that experience. So I have no, I don't get, put it like this, I don't get as offended as a lot of people who look like me because I realize a lot of things people just don't know. I mean, but I do, instead of taking offense, I take it as a teaching moment. And say, wait a minute, you can't say that to a black person. Let me tell you why. And they go, no, you can't do that. Let me tell you why. So, you know, God, I know who I am in all of this. I know who I am. And I stand in that place and space armed by the power of the Most High.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I wish we had more people like you. You know, it takes a lot of courage to use it as a teaching moment, Gail. How do you actually do that?
I think it's just, it's a God-breathed thing. Yeah. Because I'm so secure in who I am and who he created me to be that it was like that moment when that little boy called me black. I said, I am not black. I am Sienna. I get clutch my pearls moment. If you call me something other than what I know he told me I am, then there's something wrong with you, not me. I really get like, okay, we need to do a head tilt so I can educate. And I said this in a teaching voice, and I'm really good at this. I have people laughing and some of them are totally and completely offensive. And I'll say, wait a minute, before you go any further, come here, let me educate you. And if somebody gets offended, that's their problem, not mine. Because I am here, I'm a bridge between the races, the genders, the generation, and even the political parties. And when you're a bridge, you get walked on, but you can also become a toll bridge and get paid.
Okay, when you're a bridge, you get walked on. Mm-hmm. That is so important to remember.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. So I did a series years ago with a teen Sunday school, and we did Bridge Makers. And what we did is we researched the different bridges, the like major bridges and how they were built and the incredible technology and architecture and stuff that went into these bridges to make them work across huge, vast spaces. But of course, the entire purpose of the bridge was to get used, to get trampled.
And to connect bodies that normally would not even be connected. So that's what God uses me for, is a bridge. And you get walked on your bridge, but like I said, you can also become a toll bridge and get paid.
I love that. You were telling me earlier that you like to work with white men. Tell me that. Tell everybody what you tell me.
I tell them all the time. I said, okay, I love working with white men. And they're like, I said, because you guys will ask for the money. And I smile and they laugh. I said, so a lot of my collaborations are with white men and I'm on race and bias. I said, now, wait a minute, you can't teach this, but I'm going to teach you. I said, because you need to let us stand out in front. Now you help me. And, you know, and I tell them, I said, you just be back here, be my wall of protection. How about that? And they're like, we got you, Gail. But I'm very open. I am very aware of the power structure. And I said, you guys are in power. And I know that. And you know what? I admire, you know what I said to them, all men, I say, I heard somebody say this: if you're talking to a man, you're talking to one of two people, a king or a fool. Depending upon who you talk to, is who will answer to you. So I always talk to the king, and because if the fool keeps talking, the king will eventually knock the fool out of the way and answer. So I treat men with honor because a man's biggest need is for honor. And that has to do with women knowing how to lead. We're not men, so we shouldn't lead like men. We're women. We have emotional, we got something extra. But anyway, that's another story.
I love that. I just love that so much. And one of the things you talked about is that you are big on collaborating with white women. And what is your purpose in that? Okay, so someone might say to you, why don't you just pick Black women? There's so many talented, skilled Black women who could do that job you just gave to a white girl. Why did you do that?
Well, you know, I communicate, I collaborate with whoever, melanated or not. It depends. You know, this is one thing that I discovered. We have to find our tribe, and our tribe is not always among our people. Does that make sense? We have people, like-minded people, not melanated or non-melanated, but it's people who think like me. And a lot of the people I've discovered who think like me are not necessarily Black or female.
So, or American or whatever.
You know, I can kind of tell when I come into a place and space who gets me. Sure. And it's not always people who look like me. So I have this unique thing that a lot of people, we all like to congregate with people who look like us, who we think thinks like us. Look for spirit. And I look for that. And when that is like-minded, like spirit, I mean, heart to heart, breast to breast, then I can tell who they are. It doesn't matter to me how they look. It's like, can we do this? Can we take this mountain together? Can we do this together? And so it doesn't matter to me if they're white, Black, but it's just, we have to be alike.
Right. And one last thing I wanted you to talk about is sometimes there are things that a white person can't teach. Sometimes there are perspectives that possibly a Black person can't teach. Why is that?
Well, it's because we all are filled with biases. We've all been taught to feel very comfortable with people who look like us, who we believe think like us, or we just kind of are comfortable. People are, humans are creatures of habit. I have a friend who's an anthropologist, and she said humans are like herding animals. You know, all the herd follows this the same. She said, everybody wants to follow the ones that look like them. He says, and when you get one that breaks out, she says, Gail, you're the one that breaks out from the herd. I'm like, I don't like where you guys are going. And I'm in the last so bad because she's correct. The water's over here. You guys are going over there. And I'm thinking, okay. But if the people are comfortable with people who look like them and who they think thinks like them, and they oftentimes are not open to people who are different. And it's just a matter of safety. People want to feel safe, and they want to be relaxed and comfortable in their own spaces. And if they let somebody in who's different or looks different or who they believe thinks different, then they have to change. And people don't like change.
So it's for the sake of the audience.
Oftentimes, let me give you an example. I have a lot of my close friends are white girls. We white friends, you know, and they told me, they said, Gail, you've been so patient with us. I had one that called me recently. We were really, really close. And then she decided that I was an angry Black woman. She's a journalist. And I was trying to tell her what was going on in the world before social media. Because I'm a former cop. And I said, look, this is what's happening. Gail, you're just an angry Black woman. I said, no, I'm not. So fast forward, social media, she calls me weeping. And she says, can you ever forgive me? I said, forgive you for what? She says, you have so patient with me. And she said, you were so patient with me and loving and kind. And I was such an idiot. And I said, no, you weren't an idiot. You just couldn't see. And I said, now that you see it being played out, it looks very different. I'm sorry it had to come to this, but something had to happen to change that. And so she came to me and she said, I think, you know, she said, I have changed in the last decade to no small part because of your contribution to my life and just telling me like it is and helping me to see. Somebody's got to stand in the middle and say, okay, I know you don't like it, but somebody's got to change. And I'm one of those people. God's created me to do that.
I love you. I love your heart. I love your ministry. I love your book, Power of a Woman Who Leads. Thank you, Gail, for being here. And thank you for just being willing to be the bridge, to be the one that yeah, maybe sometimes gets to charge the toll, but a lot of times just gets trampled on. Thank you, my darling.
Thank you for having me as your guest today, Marnie. I really, really am honored to be here.
Oh, and you guys want to make sure to check out Gail's stuff. It's her website is handleyourbusinessgirl.com. I love that name. And you can also find more about her speaking ministry over at womenspeakers.com under North Carolina. We are here with Mary Dittmars today, and we're going to be talking about Dancing in the Minefields, which is the name of Mary's book. And this lady has a huge heart, and you have been through so much, Mary. I tell you what, you know, when you guys get to know Mary's story, you're going to really respect what she's going to share with us today, some of the aha moments that God has just brought to her heart over the years. But key to her story is her battle with alcoholism, as well as the loss of two children, one by cancer, the other by accidental death. And these are, it's like everybody's worst nightmare, right?
Right.
Beth is losing a child, let alone two children. And yet here you are today praising God, and you're just a hoot. So full of joy and so full of energy, serving people who are really hurting. Mm-hmm. And just really delighted to have you with us today.
Thank you. It's great to be here. And I am a miracle. I am a miracle.
You are. You are. And it's really fun. I'm excited to just kind of pick your brain a little bit. So the first one you wanted to share with us today is that laughter and tears are only a moment apart, but joy is eternal.
That is my tagline. That sums up my whole philosophy of life. The first son we lost was our Christopher, who was 14. He died of leukemia, but we saw an amazing transformation. It's like 2 Corinthians 4:16, where it says our outer self is wasting away, but our inner self is being renewed day by day. Hmm. He was diagnosed at the age of 10. And by the time he passed at 14, he witnessed to us. He said, Mom, Dad, don't worry. I'm going to be fine. Jesus is coming. Hmm. So he taught me that. And wow. He actually renewed my walk with the Lord.
Huh. Wow. That is just something. And it's so true that when we focus on the pain, it feels eternal.
Yes. Yeah, it feels like you're never going to get out. But, you know, Chris was so funny. He was very bloated because of the medicine and the steroids he was on. And he was like, Ma, when I get to heaven, I'm going to get my six pack back. I mean, he was talking about his glorified body.
He's
and
looking
all that.
Ahead. Yeah,
he was
right.
Thinking ahead.
Mm-hmm. Right. And that's what it said Jesus did on the cross, right? He hated the cross. And yet for the joy set before him, he endured the cross for our sake. Yeah. Beautiful. Beautiful.
Right.
Another thing you like to say is when we allow God to use us, our suffering becomes sacred.
That's so true. This is true not only in my walk as a grieving mother, but it's especially true in my walk as a woman in addiction. Because I have 16 years of recovery from alcoholism, and I used alcohol as a coping mechanism during Chris's 4 years of treatment. And I really didn't think I had a problem until I decided to cut down, and I couldn't. So now I mentor other women in recovery. I've met women in recovery who have lost children. I have spoken at different events, you know, regarding recovery, and it's been such a blessing. My suffering has become a tool, as I like to say, my mess has become my message.
Right. And your testimony. Mm-hmm. Right. And what's beautiful is that you're actually willing to be vulnerable and share it, mm-hmm. and not just tell your story and how God got you out, but also you have tools. Because you've really researched this as well, and you've really got tools that can help others to
get out from under whatever grief or addiction they are they are in. So that's so cool. Another thing you like to say is for us to understand the Lord's ways would be like teaching a dog algebra.
Yes. What do you mean?
I have this adorable lab mix who's really smart for a dog. We have to spell W-A-L-K sometimes in front of her or biscuit or whatever. But if I got out a math book and I said, oh, come here, girl, we're going to do quadratic equations now, she'd be like. And I think that's what God meant when he said, my ways are not your ways. My ways are higher than your ways. We just don't get down here, and we're not going to see the whole picture until we're with the Lord and with Jesus in heaven. We're not going to understand it. We have to accept.
I always say that if God was small enough for me to understand, he wouldn't be a very big God.
Yes, I've heard that. I like that.
Yeah. And, you know, we want to understand him, and he longs to be understood by us. And yet at the same time, I do think that there's this huge, huge chasm between what we can comprehend of him and his fullness.
Yeah, he says we must become like children, you know?
Yeah. And he sent Jesus. I mean, that was the huge part of sending Jesus, was to show us a little bit of what he's like. It's like, if he were a human, he'd act like this.
What would Jesus do?
What would Jesus do? What did Jesus do?
Yeah. And my other son that we lost, Jared, he was 21. We lost him suddenly in a car accident. So, you know, when I do my talks and workshops, I sometimes speak about the difference between prolonged suffering and sudden loss, because there is a difference. Right. Sometimes you have loss that you can't prepare for. But I saw a transformation in Jared too. And, you know, one of the last things he did before he passed away is he had caught a lot of fish because he loved fishing. Mm. He went down to a homeless camp and had a cookout for them.
Wow.
Hmm. Yeah.
Sharing the fish, which is an analogy of
biblical, right?
That's so awesome. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. A lot of your joy comes from knowing that they're okay.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah,
they're doing better than we are right
now.
Yeah,
that's right. There's so much hope in Jesus. So much hope in Jesus. We don't remember days and weeks. We remember moments.
Yes. I have a treasure trove of memories. Mm-hmm. You know, I have a daughter who's doing well, and I have grandchildren. And I'm very blessed to share my life with them. And I'm very blessed that I had a very close relationship with both the boys that, you know, that we've lost. And, you know, I don't remember what we were doing on June 12th, 1986, but I remember the expression on my son's face when he opened his favorite Christmas present, or when he saw a parrot for the first time. You know, we remember the moments.
Right. Right. And we remember the overall life too. There came a time in the city where we lived before we moved here. There were 8 young people who died in a short period of time, and none of them alcohol or drug related. None of them were suicide. They were all just random, just horrible accidents and aneurysms and, you know, cancer. Mm. It was just so many back to back. And most of them were in high school. So it was just devastating to our small community of 1,800 people. And we started to think a lot about heaven and about saying goodbye. And my children adopted the habit of every time before they left me, they would say, I love you, Mom. Because one of the dads had said how it was so important to him that the last thing his son had said to him was, I love you, Dad. And so they heard that, and they just started that. But one of the things that we also understood was that some of the parents didn't get that. Some of the parents lost their kids without that final word, without that final embrace or whatever. And it was so fascinating to watch how even in their stories, God had provided them with some encouragement, either in the last weeks or months or days of the child's life.
Yeah, and I'm very blessed that that is the last thing both of my boys said to me, even my son, who we lost suddenly, because I was getting ready to go on a trip, and we hugged each other and said, I love you. But you know what I tell, you know what I tell parents who lost children and maybe in less comforting circumstances? Yes. I tell them, your child has the same God that my child has. And even though your son didn't get to say, I love you, he went to the same place and he has the same loving father.
Yeah. Yeah. And there, and all the things that you've said and done through the years all matter. It's not just the last few words you say to each other. It all counts. It all counts. When we allow our grief to be pushed aside, then anger replaces it.
That's right. Yes. And then, it's so true. There's people have to be given permission to grieve. The grief, your grief has to have a voice. That was one of my reasons for writing books and blogging, is to give other suffering parents permission to give their grief a voice.
I think in America, and I work with especially moms on this one, because we tend to not grieve anything. We don't want to allow ourselves to grieve anything. So for example, a new baby comes into the family. Well, that is so exciting that you feel a little guilty grieving that you've just lost your sleep. You've lost the private time you used to have with your husband. You've lost all of your autonomy for a long time. I mean, you've really lost quite a lot when that new baby comes.
You've lost the ability to have adult conversations.
You have right now. You battle. And so, you know, when we fail to take a moment to grieve those losses, we really do set ourselves up to be very angry. And it's kind of like pretending that we didn't lose anything, you know, to be joyful or whatever it is. And it's just not, it's not healthy, and it's not what God calls us to.
And we had to do a lot of grieving because when Chris was on treatment, because we had a child with cancer for 4 years, and he had to grieve the loss of being able to go outside and play. He had to grieve the loss of going to school and seeing his friends. So, you know, there's a lot of people out there whose loved one hasn't necessarily died, but they're still grieving other losses.
We sure see that with dementia patients. I watched it first with my father-in-law, and I decided at that point, wow, mom's really grieving, but she can't really show it because he's still here. And so we find ourselves in these situations, but it talks in the Bible about godly grief and how important it is for us to grieve, but not like the world grieves, not without hope. And
yes.
So, you know, there comes in this joy and this hopefulness as we grieve.
One of my favorite passages is Romans 5:1, where it talks about suffering produces perseverance, perseverance produces character, and character produces hope.
Yeah.
One of my favorite.
And with hope, without hope, the heart fails, right? That's what the Bible says.
I don't know how people without faith get up in this 2020 right now and function, really.
Yeah. Right, right. It is so much easier. It is so much easier for us who have faith in Jesus Christ to get up and function because there's so much hope. There's no matter what happens. No matter what happens, no matter what civil unrest, no matter what the elections do, no matter what the economy does, we have so much hope in Jesus Christ himself. That is
right.
Where our hope resides.
Right.
Yeah, so good. Sometimes my life felt like I was stepping on Legos and I couldn't find the light switch. Oh, we can all relate to that pain.
You get up in the morning, you know, and it's dark and the kids have left the Legos. Oh, you know, that's how my life felt at times. And, you know, many years ago when Chris first got sick, I relieved myself with, you know, alcohol. And it was when I surrendered to the fact that I needed help, I looked upward finally. And by the time we lost Jared actually had better parents than Chris had, because Jared was our youngest. So Jared had a sober, very church connected mom, whereas, you know, but I learned that I didn't have to deal with the pain, you know, with worshiping a false idol.
Yeah.
But, you know, it still hurts, though.
Oh, my goodness.
It still hurts. You know, we don't get saved and then sing Kumbaya. You know,
every problem doesn't just magically disappear. No. Right. Right. But we have someone who understands. And I think, you know, that's one of the things that became clear to me. I remember one time being in the hospital. I'd been taken into the hospital by ambulance. And that night I missed my son's choir concert. And it was devastating to me. I wanted to be there, you know. Yeah. And I thought, nobody else in the whole world is feeling this exact sadness right now that I'm feeling.
That's right. That's right.
It's very lonely, except that we have Jesus. Yeah.
It's very lonely, and nobody knows what it feels like to lose your particular child or your particular spouse. It's a unique type of experience, and men and women grieve differently too.
Oh, absolutely. And every situation is so different. You know, you can't ever really say, I know what you're going through, but you can say, I can only imagine what you might
be feeling. I love that song too.
I know, I do too. And it brings it to mind when I say that. But I would never, even if I've gone through something almost exactly the same as someone else, I would never say, I know exactly how you feel, because we don't know how the other person feels. We haven't had their background. We haven't had their life experiences. We didn't have their relationship with that person. We didn't, right. We won't have their loss.
That's
right. So unique. Yeah. That's so right. To extend love and compassion and point them toward Jesus is the best thing. The last one here is, one of the best things we can do as a parent is to sit down and have dinner with our children.
Yes. We continued that even when Chris was sick, because children need to be heard. And you know, that other quote, that we talked about earlier about remembering the moments. A lot of moments are created around the dinner table. And by the time our children were teenagers, phones had come into the picture.
Yes.
So the phones had to go away at the dinner table. Some of my friends actually had a basket where they had to park their phones. It was their phone parking lot for dinner time.
Love it.
But it's a practice that's just not continued enough. And I believe Satan's really attacking the family unit in this country. And I'm just so glad I had all those years of sitting down with the kids, especially the boys. You know, we tell jokes. We would process what was going on at school. Mom, there's a bully. How should I handle it? You know, we listened. We processed. Families are just in such a hurry now, and everybody's got their face in a screen. It's a lost art.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so valuable. When you're talking about moments, our youngest son, Timothy, I've always called Tim the life of my party, because he was wild since he was inside of me.
And get away in there.
Everybody that knows Tim has Timmy stories from when he was little.
Oh, that's
funny. But he was the youngest of three. And so the other two left first, and then we had Tim. But then sometimes we would all be home together. And then sometimes we would be home together, but then Tim wasn't there. And we realized that these dinners without Tim, finally we realized that the problem was that Tim wasn't there. So we had always had hilarious fun dinners together because Tim was the life of the party. And then whenever Tim wasn't there, we would just have these normal dinners and we'd have normal conversations and they would just be kind of, you know, just normal and average. But the memories, when you said creating memories, it's so true that just spending time together is the key. You can never get back what you didn't do. And so making that a priority along the way.
Yes. With both parents working, we made it a priority.
Yeah. And aren't you glad you did? Yeah.
I am glad, because I have, you know, more memories than a parent who was more rushed would have.
Right. Right. So do you have a favorite verse that you would like to share with us? Like maybe a life verse or one that you've gone to many times for comfort?
I love Psalm 91:4. He will cover you with his feathers, and under his wings you will find refuge. His faithfulness will be your shield and your rampart.
I love Psalm 91. A perfect comforting psalm for two.
Well, there's a story behind it too.
Go ahead. Yeah.
My oldest son, Chris, when he was on his deathbed, my husband asked him to let us know he made it to heaven okay. And Chris said, well, Dad, I'm going to be new in heaven. I don't know what Jesus is going to let me do. I know, it was like role reversal.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and Rob said, could you put a feather under my pillow?
Huh.
And 3 days after Chris passed, the Lord, in his mercy, gave us a miracle. Our bed was covered in feathers. Covered. And we had no down comforter. We had a couple of small down pillows, but I mean, they were full. And there are other times in my life when, you know, I've gotten little God winks. And what's funny is when it happened, I had never heard Psalm 91:4. So when I told that story to someone and they showed it to me, I was like,
yes. Oh, I just love it.
Yeah, it was a little miracle God allowed in our lives. It really did happen.
You know, God is always present with us, and it just takes our breath away when he makes himself visible in ways like that, doesn't it?
Yes. I have more stories.
Yes, I'm sure you do. And make sure to check out Mary Beth's book, as well as invite her to speak at your women's events and for your groups that are going through either addiction recovery or grief recovery. And you can learn more about her at her own website, marybethdittmars.com, or she's in Florida and you can learn more about her at womenspeakers.com. Thank you all so much for being here, and I hope you have a wonderful rest of your week.